Andy, we've got some questions about following mesolate formation in formulation. And in particular, would you study mesolate formation in a formulation containing excipients with alcohol groups, such as mannitol and sorbitol?
That's a very interesting question. Although we've not directly covered this in the results that I've presented here, it is something that prior to the actual studies that were carried out through PQRI was something that we ourselves within AstraZeneca actively looked at. And certainly in relation to the studies we did of that nature, we actually did not see any formation of sulfonate esters, mesylate esters, as a result of either the formulation or of formulation processes such as wet granulation in an alcohol system. If you reflect on the results that have been presented, I guess in many ways that's not surprising, insofar as we have already clearly demonstrated that the reaction itself is it's mediated and driven by acidity. And indeed, in order for a reaction to occur within the formulated product or on formulation, what in essence would have to happen would be that you would have to get effectively dissociation of the salt, basically freeing up the proton from the base in order to initiate that reaction. And certainly, I think that is very, very unlikely. And as I say, that's been our own findings when we ourselves have carried out these kind of studies. We've seen absolutely no evidence of the formation of these species actually either in the formulated product or actually during the formulated process. And as I say, I believe that's because that reaction would have to involve that initial decomposition of the salt in order to instigate such a reaction. I don't know if, Steve, if you particularly yourself want to add anything further from your perspective, from a technical point of view.
No, I think that sort of is an answer which fits within our experience from this particular work. One of the sub-questions from that one, Andy, related to it being a solid formulation with low water content. Do you think that alters the learning?
I don't see an obvious reason as to why it would, because, again, unless there was any clear evidence of actual dissociation of the salt, I think the reaction itself would be very unlikely. In fact, you could even postulate that where there's a very low water content, that might in itself actually prevent any dissociation, because you know dissociation itself might be in some way related to some kind of hydrolytic process. Certainly, I think it is something that potentially could be studied further, and certainly the methodology that's been described here could be something that could ultimately be used for that. But I think it's very doubtful, based on the results we got from these studies, that that kind of reaction would occur and that it would be in any way promoted by having an anhydrous condition within the formulated product.
Okay, thanks, Andy. There was a comment of him to switch tack to the labelling work and the formation mechanism. A question whether we had tried to specifically detect the 18 oxygen labelled ester.
Yes, we had. I mean, what we did was we basically monitored that reaction using GCMS. We used single line monitoring at the expected mass units associated both with the O18 labelled water, obviously 20, but also as well we specifically did single line monitoring around the molecular weight that would be associated with the O18 labelled EMS, and we saw absolutely no evidence of that forming whatsoever.
Yes, my recollection was that the mass spectral traces, the GCMS traces were essentially identical as far as the ion pattern for the sulfonates that we were directly analyzing for in that work.
Yes. I mean, there was absolutely no evidence that the trace itself, the total ion current at the actual molecular weight for the EO18 labeled ester, it was completely flat. There was no evidence whatsoever of that being present, whereas there was a very distinct and very clear peak associated with the EO18 labeled water. So it's very, very clear in that respect.
Okay, thanks. A question based on this presentation was, should we continue to test our APIs for sulfonate esters and control to genotoxin purity levels?
That's a very, very good question. I think what we would hope has been amply demonstrated as far as this work is concerned is that the control of sulfonate esters is something that's readily achievable, and certainly in a scenario whereby you can clearly prove that as far as your process is concerned, you have used a stoichiometric amount or even in excess of the base, then that should go a very, very long way to assuage any concerns regarding sulfonate esters. It's really a question, I think, for regulatory authorities with regard as to whether or not that in isolation is sufficient proof of this. It is to be hoped that this logical scientific-based argument such as that would be accepted, but it may well be, certainly for a period of time, that might have to be augmented by some form of an analysis in relation to that. I certainly, though, would not expect on the basis of this to actually have to routinely test for this and to have a specification clause relating to sulfonate esters. I would think as an absolute maximum, it should be sufficient to actually use the scientific argument and augment that with a certain amount of batch data which demonstrates the fact that we have no ester present under the kind of conditions typically employed for that particular process. That's how I would certainly approach this.
Yeah. One of the pre-questions was, had we any views on how many batches you would have to test to demonstrate or prove that the BGI is not present in the final API?
Yeah, this is a question that's generally asked around genotoxic impurities as a whole, really, in the entire class. Certainly based on our experience and dialogue with regulatory authorities, I think where it's necessary to do that, certainly, for instance, you're operating a suboptimal process where you know you would or would predict you'd get some ester formation, therefore want to demonstrate that the process was robust enough to eliminate any ester formed. In that particular case, I would typically advise to collect data from probably a minimum of 10 batches, and for argument's sake, in terms of an appropriate level to demonstrate absence, if, for instance, your permissible level based on the TTC was, if for instance, 10 ppm. If you were to over 10 batches demonstrate that you had less than 1 ppm present of the ester of concern, then I would hope that that would be sufficient information to prove that you had a robust process and therefore would not need to actually include and have long-term testing in a specification clause relating to this.
Okay. The a follow-on from that was really about the need to conduct purging studies during process development.
Yes.
What you see is the teaching from this work on the design of that sort of experimentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, again, I think it relates to the specifics of the actual process concerned. I mean, go back to the point that if we're talking about actually having a one-to-one stoichiometry of the sulfonic acid and the API base, then it shouldn't really be necessary, or that should negate the need to actually do spherical spiking experiments. But if you have a scenario whereby we are using a suboptimal process where we might actually have some ester formation, albeit in the actual reaction solution, I think the best advice I would give in relation to that is to actually use the teaching from this work, look at comparing that particular process to the kind of processes that were described through this presentation, and use this really to predict the amount of ester that would typically, or you would expect to form under the kind of conditions that are employed in that process, then to use that and then base your spiking really around that. And what I would typically recommend would be that if, for instance, you theoretically would form, for instance, 100 ppm in a reaction solution. It might be sensible from the purposes of a spiking experiment to see a spike at a level tenfold higher than that and demonstrate, therefore, you have a very robust process that could eliminate levels well in excess of that that actually would theoretically be the maximum level formed in the process. That's certainly how I would approach it if we're talking about suboptimal process.
Okay, I would agree with you entirely on that, and it leads on to another comment that somebody's made, is whether you consider that regulators may be more open, especially with quality by design, to this type of scientific rationale to justify whether ultimate controls are needed.
Certainly that was one of the clear stated aims of this work, was to actually do a really extensive and very thorough investigation into the reaction between sulfonic acids and alcohols, with the ultimate aim of being able to actually clearly demonstrate through that, through good sound science, that actually that as far as this problem is concerned, that it's far less of an issue than certainly had been, I think, the belief of many regulatory authorities. This, to be hoped, because of the sound scientific basis that underpins this work, particularly around the clear understanding of the mechanism, that would be something that would be taken into consideration as part of a discussion around the specific issue with a regulatory authority. I mean, I can't obviously answer directly for regulatory authorities, but I hope that in many ways we've met some of the prerequisites that certainly were defined at the beginning of this by the FDA in terms of what they wanted to see specifically coming out of these studies. So I guess this, as far as response from regulatory authorities is concerned, it's a bit, I think, at the moment a case of watch this space, but certainly we ourselves with AstraZeneca, and I'm sure many of the other companies who are part of the working group, will definitely be using the teachings from these particular studies as part of their argumentation going forward in this area.
Okay, thanks, Andy. Yeah, I think it's the comment I'd add to this would be as well with respect to some of the earlier questions around formulation, that with the understanding on the significance of proton for the mechanism for formation for esters, in formulations, the degree of acidity is unlikely to be anywhere near high enough, in other words, the pH low enough to promote the reaction to form esters. So again, it feeds into the understanding element of quality by design.
Absolutely, yeah. I totally agree.
We have one question about the degradation work, distinguishing whether the methodology that we use distinguishes between the presence of methyl mesylate and the question says methylated lutidine. I wondered if you had any comments on the nature of the method and the specificity for methyl mesylate in the degradation studies, solvology studies.
Well, certainly in terms of specifically, the studies themselves are actually specifically focused on actually looking at the remaining level of the methyl mesylate in the system. So the method was based around the method described, i.e. that an aliquot sample was taken and it subsequently underwent the derivatization process. So it was actually focused on looking specifically for that derivatized species. So from that point of view, we actually specifically looked for, in that case, the residual level of MMS. We didn't, and certainly to the best of my knowledge, actually deliberately look at the potential for methylated 2,6-lutidine. So as I say, I think it was very much was focused on just looking at the and studying the amount of residual MMS under the solvolysis conditions, and just focus primarily on that. At least that's my recollection. I don't believe we collected that other data.
It's my collection recollection as well, Andy. I hope that that gives that question some more information. there is a question again coming back to the consumption of a sulfonate salt with whiskey and the stomach. I guess I know my take on the answer to that one, which you covered in part of the talk, Andy. But do you have anything more that you'd like to add on that?
Well, really, to just if you look at the actual reaction profile for that, which it was, we were using as an analogy for that kind of scenario, where in that profile that I demonstrated, what you effectively have is a situation where you have what in effect would be the equivalent of having your entire stomach full of neat scotch. And even under that scenario, even at a temperature of 60 degrees, then what we saw was we only saw low ppm levels of actual conversion. So if you then equate that into the more normal situation, circumstance you'd have in your stomach, which is where you're taking that scotch, but that in itself would then be very, very quickly diluted by the other contents in the stomach. So we see a very, very rapid dilution of that, and also potentially adsorption of the alcohol that's involved as well. I think when you reflect it into those conditions and also the temperature the stomach's held at, I think that it's, you know, extremely unlikely that under those conditions that you would get any real effective formation at all, because you're going to be taking this into the realms of having what in effect is almost an entirely aqueous environment by the time you're taking into consideration the volume of the stomach that already pre-exists the alcohol entering the system.
Yeah, I think my take on that again is the time frame of the data that we collected. The formation of ester was there are many hours, and I would suspect that if you had your stomach contents at 60 degrees for many hours, you may have other problems.
Yes, particularly if it was completely full of neat scotch. Yes.
However, thank you for the question. We have one question about the range of the studies and whether we had considered tertiary butanol. This questioner highlights that there is some old literature indicating that tertiary butanol mesylate is not stable.
No, we didn't consider that, mainly from the perspective that certainly informs in terms of salt formation. I don't think it's a solvent that's readily used for that particular purpose. However, what I would say is that with the methodology that's defined with through the studies we've done, it would be entirely possible and rather straightforward to simply do that exact experiment, substituting T-butanol for the alcohol studied up to this point. I would expect that we would see certainly a very similar profile to which we'd seen with the other alcohols, frankly, in terms of that we would see some conversion within the binary system, although it may well be that the ester in that particular case may well be less stable, which would actually inhibit its formation. If that was the case, but I would expect to see some limited conversion formation in the binary system. But equally as well, I would also expect that where we have the base presence, that I can't think of an obvious reason as to why that system would be any different than the other alcohol systems, i.e. that the teaching that we have from the mechanism would suggest that where we have a one-to-one stoichiometry, in this instance, present in T-butanol, that we would still see no reaction. But as I said, that would be something that with this methodology, should we wish to do so, we could very quickly establish that by doing and essentially repeating the experiment with T-butanol.
Yes, it's certainly not a solvent that we included because it isn't a common process solvent to the best of the groups that knowledge at the time.
I think one of the problems with T-butanol and why it's not is that itself it's actually got a relatively high melting point in terms from a solvent perspective, and therefore certainly if you're doing some kind of salt recrystallization process, you do run a very real risk of when you're trying to isolate the material actually getting crystallization of T-butanol itself. So I think that could be part of the reason why it's not a common solvent in that respect.
I would agree. One question seeks a confirmation of their take from the presentation, and that's about API salts, which may have some residual alcohol, maybe they suggest 0.5% isopropanol, and whether ester will form during storage. Their take from the presentation that there should be no issue at all from that, and asking if their interpretation was correct.
That would certainly be my interpretation as well, and it really goes back to the previous point about in order for there to be formation in the solid state on stability, that it would have to involve some form of dissociation of the salt species itself to basically free up that proton to actually mediate the actual reaction. Certainly based on our own internal studies, which, as I said, a lot of such studies were carried out before we'd done this particular package of work, but where we had studied this, we'd certainly never seen any evidence of ester formation on stability, and that included across the full range of ICH stability studies, so particularly around to this may well be the 4075, where you got a very high around the fumidity, but even under those kind of stress conditions, you know, we didn't see any evidence of this at all, which really back up the sort of the what we all believe are the sort of key points from these studies.
Thanks. Just as a flag to the folk out there, I have got just one question remaining on the list. So if anybody has got any other last minute questions, could you post them now? The final question is one as to how should one set specification limits for sulfonate esters in API?
Well, I would hope that by employing the actual kind of teachings that we have in terms of process controls that we can now easily apply to the kind of salt formation processes we're talking about, that by doing that we should really effectively eliminate the need to actually set a specification, that even under those conditions which you might define as being suboptimal, where we might see albeit low level formation in the actual system, that it is hoped that by having an understanding of the levels that would form, that you would be able to develop an effective purge process to eliminate the sulfonate ester. So even under the scenario where you have a suboptimal process where you can get ester formation, what I would expect that people typically to do would be to do the additional validation where there was required to demonstrate the process was robust enough to actually eliminate the risk, and effectively validate the process in that way, ultimately doing away with the need to have a formal specification and long-term control method for this particular type of analysis. So I certainly would look to avoid having to actually have that kind of specification in place. Of course, if a specification was needed, and clearly it would be based around appropriate limits for the sulfonate ester in question, and that itself, of course, would be based on the TTC. But I hope, as I say, for the reasons I described, that would be something that could be avoided.
Okay, thanks, Andy. Well, we appear to have hopefully covered the questions that have been posed. So I'd like to thank you out there in the audience for and in the webinar for posing the questions. So I'd like to thank Andy Teasdale for the presentation, and on behalf of the Product Quality Research Institute, again I thank you all for your participation.